Fawcett had received death threats, and during the trial, he had moved around with protection. The threats were thoroughly investigated and found not to be credible, but the bodyguards remained close by. Intimidation is an unlikely motive. Fawcett has made his decision, and though his name is poisoned among the environmentalists, he has done his damage. His ruling was confirmed in 2009 by the Fourth Circuit, and the case is now headed for the U.S. Supreme Court. Pending the appeals, the uranium has not been touched. Revenge is a motive, though the FBI says nothing about it. The words contract killing are being used by some reporters, who apparently have nothing to base this on except for the professionalism of the killings. Given the crime scene and the empty safe that was so carefully hidden, robbery seems the likelier motive. I have a plan. One I have been plotting for years now. It is my only way out. Chapter 5. Every able-bodied federal inmate is required to have a job, and the Bureau of Prisons controls the pay scale. For the past 2 years, I have been the librarian, and for my labors, I get 30 cents an hour. About half of this money, along with the checks from my father, is subject to the Inmate Financial Responsibility Program. The Bureau of Prisons takes the money and applies it to felony assessments, fines, and restitution. Along with my 10-year sentence, I was ordered to pay about $120,000 in various penalties. At 30 cents an hour, it will take the rest of this century and then some. Other jobs around here include cook, dishwasher, table wiper, floor scrubber, plumber, electrician, carpenter, clerk, orderly, laundry worker, painter, gardener, and teacher. I consider myself lucky. My job is one of the best and does not reduce me to cleaning up after people. I occasionally teach a course in history for inmates pursuing their high school equivalency diplomas. Teaching pays 35 cents an hour, but I am not tempted by the higher wages. I find it quite depressing because of the low levels of literacy among the prison populations. Blacks, whites, browns, it doesn't matter. So many of these guys can barely read and write. It makes you wonder what's happening in our educational system. But I'm not here to fix the educational system, nor the legal, judicial, or prison systems. I'm here to survive one day at a time, and in doing so, maintain as much self-respect and dignity as possible. We are scum, nobodies, common criminals locked away from society, and reminders of this are never far away. A prison guard is called a correction officer, or simply a CO. Never refer to one as a guard. No, sir. Being a CO is far superior. It's more of a title. Most COs are former cops or deputies or military types who didn't do too well in those jobs and now work in prison. There are a few good ones, but most are losers who are too stupid to realize they are losers. And who are we to tell them? They are vastly superior to us, regardless of their stupidity, and they enjoy reminding us of this. They rotate COs to avoid one getting too close to an inmate. I suppose this happens, but one of the cardinal rules of inmate survival is to avoid your CO as much as possible. Treat him with respect, do exactly what he says, cause him no trouble. But above all, try to avoid him. My current CO is not one of the better ones. He is Darryl Marvin, a thick-chested, pot-bellied white boy of no more than 30 who tries to swagger but has too much tonnage on his hips. Darryl is an ignorant racist who does not like me because I am black and I have 2 college degrees, which is 2 more than he has. A fierce internal battle rages every time I'm forced to suck up to this thug. But I have no choice. Right now, I need him. Good morning, Officer Marvin, I say with a fake smile as I stop him outside the chow hall. What is it, Bannister? He growls. I hand over a sheet of paper, an official request form. He takes it and makes a pretense of reading it. I'm tempted to help him with the longer words, but bite my tongue. I need to see the warden, I say politely. Why do you want to see the warden? He asks, still trying to read the rather simple request. My business with the warden is of no concern to the CO, or anyone else, but to remind Daryl of this would only cause trouble. My grandmother is almost dead, and I would like to go to her funeral. It's only 60 miles away. When do you think she might die? He asks. Such a clever smartass. Soon. Please, Officer Marvin. I have not seen her in years. The warden does not approve crap like this, Bannister. You should know this by now. I know. But the warden owes me a favor. I gave him some legal advice a few months ago. Please, just pass it along. He folds the sheet of paper and stuffs it into a pocket. All right, but it's a waste of time. Thanks. Both of my grandmothers died years ago. Nothing in prison is designed for the convenience of the prisoner. The granting or denying of a simple request should take a few hours, but that would be too easy. 4 days pass before Daryl informs me that I am to report to the warden's office at 10 o'clock a.m. tomorrow, February 18th. Another fake smile, and I say, thanks. The warden is the king of this little empire, with the expected ego of one who rules by edict or thinks he should. These guys come and go, and it's impossible to understand the purpose of all the transfers. Again, it's not my job to reform our prison system, so I don't worry about what happens in the administration building. The current one is Mr. Robert Earl Wade, a career corrections man who's all business. He's fresh off his second divorce. And I did indeed explain to him some of the basics regarding Maryland alimony law. I enter his office. He does not stand or offer a hand or extend any courtesy that might indicate respect. He says, "Hello, Bannister," as he waves at an empty chair. "Hello, Warden Wade. How have you been?" I ease into the chair. "I'm a free man, Bannister. Number two is history, and I'll never marry again." "Nice to hear, and glad to help." With the warm-up quickly over, he shoves a notepad and says, "I can't let you guys go home for every funeral, Bannister. You gotta understand this." "This is not about a funeral," I say. "I have no grandmother." "What the hell? Are you keeping up with the murder investigation of Judge Fawcett down in Roanoke?" He frowns and jerks his head back as if he's been insulted. I'm here under false pretenses, and somewhere deep in one of the countless federal manuals, there must be a violation for this. As he tries to react, he shakes his head and repeats himself. "What the hell?" "The murder of the federal judge. It's all over the press." It's hard to believe he could have missed the story of the murder, but it's also entirely possible. Just because I read several newspapers a day doesn't mean everyone does. "The federal judge?" he asks. "That's him. They found him with his girlfriend in a lake cabin in Southwest Virginia. Both shot." "Sure, sure. I've seen the stories. What's this got to do with you?" He's ticked off because I've lied to him, and he's trying to think of the appropriate punishment. A supreme and mighty man like a warden cannot get himself used by an inmate. Robert Earl's eyes are darting around as he decides how to react to my trickery. I need to sound as dramatic as possible, because Wade will probably laugh when I answer his question. Inmates have far too much spare time to develop intricate claims of their innocence, or to cook up conspiracy theories involving unsolved crimes, or to gather secrets that might be swapped for a sudden parole. In short, inmates are always scheming ways to get out, and I'm sure Robert Earl has seen and heard it all. I know who killed the judge, I say as seriously as possible. Much to my relief, he does not crack a smile. He rocks back in his chair, pulls at his chin, and begins to nod. "And how did you come across this information?" he asks. "I met the killer." "In here or on the outside?" "I can't say, Warden, but I'm not bullshitting you. Based on what I'm reading in the press, the FBI investigation isn't going anywhere. And it won't. My disciplinary record is without blemish. I have never uttered a wrong word to a prison official. I have never complained. There is no contraband in my cell. Not even an extra packet of sugar from the chow hall. I do not gamble or borrow money. I have helped dozens of fellow inmates, as well as a few civilians, including the warden, with their legal problems. My library is kept in meticulous order. The point being, for an inmate, I have credibility." He leans forward on his elbows and exposes his yellow teeth. He has dark circles under his eyes, which are always moist, the eyes of a drinker. "And let me guess, Bannister, you would like to share this information with the FBI, cut a deal, and get out of prison, right?" "Absolutely, sir. That's my plan." Finally, the laugh. A long, high-pitched cackle that in itself would be the source of much humor. When he winds down, he says, "When is your release?" "5 years." "Oh, so this is a hell of a deal, right? Just give them a name and trot right out of here 5 years ahead of schedule." "Nothing is that simple." "What do you want me to do, Bannister?" he snarls, the laughter long gone. "Call the FBI and tell them I got a guy who knows the killer and is ready to cut a deal? They're probably getting 100 calls a day, most from fruitcake sniffing around for the reward money. Why would I risk my credibility playing that game?" "Because I know the truth, and you know I'm not a fruitcake, nor a bullshitter."
"Why don't you just write them a letter? Keep me out of it."
"I will, if that's what you want. But you'll be involved at some point because I swear I'm going to convince the FBI. We'll cut our deal, and I'll say goodbye. You'll be here for the logistics." He slumps back in his chair as if overwhelmed by the pressure of his office. He picks his nose with a thumb.
"You know, Bannister, as of this morning, I have 602 men here at Frostburg. And you are the last one I would expect to sneak in my office with such a screwball idea. The very last."
"Thank you. Don't mention it." I lean forward and stare him in the eyes. "Look, Warden, I know what I'm talking about. I know you can't trust an inmate, but just hear me out. I have some extremely valuable information, and the FBI will be desperate to have it. Please call them."
"I don't know, Bannister. We'll both look like fools. Please. I might think about it. Now shove off and tell Officer Marvin that I denied your request to go to the funeral. Yes, sir, and thanks. My hunch is that the warden will not be able to resist a little excitement. Running a no-security camp filled with well-behaved inmates is a dull job. Why not get involved in the most notorious murder investigation in the country? I leave the administration building and head across the quad, the central area of our camp. On the west side are two dormitories that house 150 men each, and these are matched by identical buildings on the east side of the quad. East campus and west campus, as though one were strolling through a pleasant little college. The COs have a break room near the chow hall, and here I find dear Officer Marvin. If I set foot inside the break room, I would probably be shot or hanged. The metal door is open, though, and I can see inside. Marvin is sprawled in a folding chair, cup of coffee in one hand and a thick pastry in the other. He's laughing along with two other COs. If hooked by the necks and weighed together on meat scales, the three would push 1,000 pounds. "What do you want, Bannister?" Darryl growls when he sees me. "Just wanted to say thanks, officer. The warden said no, but thanks anyway." "You got it, Bannister. Sorry about your grandmother." And with that, one of the guards kicks the door closed. It slams hard in my face. The metal crashes and vibrates. And for a split second, it shakes me to the core. I have heard that sound before. My arrest. The Downtown Civic Club met for lunch each Wednesday at the historic George Washington Hotel, a 5-minute walk from my office. There were about 75 members, and all but three were white. On that day, I happened to be the only black guy in attendance. Not that this was of any significance. I was sitting at a long table, choking down the usual rubber chicken and cold peas and shooting the bull with the mayor and a State Farm agent. We had covered the usual topics, the weather and football, and we had touched lightly on politics, but this was always done with great care. It was a typical civic club lunch. 30 minutes for the food, followed by 30 minutes from a speaker who was usually not too exciting. However, on this memorable day, I would not be allowed to hear the speech. There was a commotion at the door of the banquet hall. Then, suddenly, a squad of heavily armed federal agents swarmed the room as if they were about to kill all of us. A SWAT team in complete ninja attire. Black uniforms, thick vests, serious firearms, and those German combat helmets made famous by Hitler's troops. One of them yelled, "Malcolm Bannister!" I instinctively stood and mumbled, "What the hell?" At least 5 automatic rifles were instantly aimed at me. "Hands up!" the fearless leader yelled, and I raised my hands. In a matter of seconds, my hands were yanked down, slapped together behind me, and for the first time in my life, I felt the indescribable pinch of thick cuffs on my wrists. It is a horrible feeling, and unforgettable. I was shoved down the narrow aisle between the dining tables and hustled out of the room. The last thing I heard was the mayor shouting, "This is an outrage!" Needless to say, the dramatic invasion put a damper on the rest of the Civic Club meeting. With these paramilitary goons swarming around me, I was taken through the lobby of the hotel and out the front door. Someone had graciously tipped off the local television station, and a camera crew filmed away as I was shoved into the rear seat of a black Chevrolet Tahoe, a goon on each side. As we headed for the city jail, I said, "Is all of this really necessary?" The leader, riding front seat shotgun, said, "Just shut up," without turning around. "Well, I really don't have to shut up," I said. You can arrest me, but you can't make me shut up. Do you realize this? Just shut up. The goon on my right placed the barrel of his rifle on my knee. Please move that gun, would you? I said. But the gun did not move. We drove on. I said, Are you guys getting your rocks off on this? Must be terribly exciting to dash about like real tough guys, roughing up innocent people. Sort of like the Gestapo. I said, shut up. And I said, I'm not shutting up. You got a warrant for my arrest? I do. Let me see it. I'll show it to you at the jail. For now, just shut up. Why don't you shut up, okay? I could see a portion of his neck just under his German combat helmet, and it was turning red as he fumed. I took a deep breath and told myself to be cool. The helmet. I had worn the same type during my 4 years in the Marines. 4 years of active duty that included live combat in the First Gulf War. 2nd Regiment, 8th Battalion, 2nd Division, U.S. Marine Corps. We had been the first U.S. troops to engage the Iraqis in Kuwait. It wasn't much of a fight, but I saw enough dead and wounded on both sides. Now I was surrounded by a bunch of toy soldiers who'd never heard a shot fired in anger and couldn't run a mile without collapsing. And they were the good guys. When we arrived at the jail, there was a photographer from the local newspaper. My goons walked me slowly inside, making sure I would be well photographed. Their version of the perp walk. I would soon learn that another team of government thugs had raided the offices of Copeland, Reed, and Bannister at about the same time I was sitting down for lunch with my fellow civic club members. With brilliant forethought and meticulous planning, the Joint Strike Force waited until the noon hour when the only person in the office was poor Mrs. Henderson. She reported that they stormed through the front door with guns drawn, yelling, cursing, threatening. They tossed a search warrant on her desk, made her sit in a chair by the window, promised to arrest her if she did little more than breathe, then proceeded to ransack our modest suite of offices. They hauled away all of the computers, printers, and several dozen boxes of files. At some point, Mr. Copeland returned from lunch. When he protested, a gun was aimed at him, and he took a seat beside a weeping Mrs. Henderson. My arrest was certainly a surprise. I had been dealing with the FBI for over a year. I had hired a lawyer, and we had done everything possible to cooperate. I had passed 2 polygraph examinations administered by the FBI's own experts. We had turned over all of the paperwork that I, as a lawyer, could ethically show anyone. I had kept a lot of this from Dion, but she knew I was worried sick. I battled insomnia. I struggled to eat when I had no appetite. Finally, after almost 12 months of my living in fear and dreading the knock on the door, the FBI informed my lawyer that the government no longer had any interest in me. The government lied, and not for the first or last time. Inside the jail, a place I visited at least twice a week, there was yet another squad of agents. They wore navy parkas with FBI stamped in bold yellow lettering across the backs, and they buzzed around with great purpose. Though I could not tell exactly what they were doing. The local cops, many of whom I knew well, backed away and looked at me with confusion and pity. Was it really necessary to send 2 dozen federal agents to arrest me and confiscate my files? I had just walked from my office to the George Washington Hotel. Any half-assed cop on his lunch break could have stopped me and made the arrest. But that would take the joy out of what these vastly important people did for a living. They led me to a small room, sat me at a table, removed the handcuffs, and told me to wait. A few minutes later, a man in a dark suit entered the room and said, "I'm Special Agent Don Connor, FBI." "A real pleasure," I said. He dropped some papers on the table in front of me and said, "This is the warrant for your arrest." Then he dropped a thick bunch of stapled papers. "And this is the indictment. I'll give you a few minutes to read it." With that, he turned and left the room, slamming the door behind him as hard as possible. It was a thick metal door, and it crashed and vibrated, and the sound rattled around the room for a few seconds. A sound I will never forget. Chapter 6. 3 days after my first meeting with Warden Wade, I am summoned back to his office. When I walk in, he is alone, on the phone, engaged in an important conversation. I stand awkwardly by the door, waiting. When he finishes his end of the chat with a rude, "That'll do," he gets to his feet and says, "Follow me." We walk through a side door into an adjacent conference room painted in the typical government pale green and equipped with far more metal chairs than could ever be used. An audit last year revealed that the Bureau of Prisons had purchased, for administrative use, 4,000 chairs at $800 per chair. The same manufacturer sold the same chair at wholesale for $79. I shouldn't care anymore, but working for 30 cents an hour gives one a different perspective when it comes to handling money. "Have a seat," he says, and I sit in one of the ugly and overpriced chairs. He selects one across the table because there must always be a barrier between us. I glance around and count 22 chairs. "Let it go. I called Washington after you left the other day," he says gravely, as if he checks in with the White House on a regular basis. "The Bureau advised me to use my own discretion. I kicked it around for a few hours, then got in touch with the FBI down in Roanoke. They've sent two guys up. They're waiting down the hall." I maintain a poker face, though I am thrilled to hear this. He points a finger at me and says, "I'm warning you, Bannister. If this turns out to be a scam, and I get embarrassed, then I'll do whatever I can to make your life miserable." "It's not a scam, Warden. I swear." "I don't know why I believe you. You won't be sorry." From his pocket, he removes his reading glasses, perches them halfway down his nose, and looks at a slip of paper. "I spoke with Assistant Director Victor Westlake, the guy in charge of the investigation. He sent two of his men to have a chat with you, Agent Hansky and Agent Arardi. I did not reveal your name, so they know nothing." "Thank you, Warden." "Stay here." He gently slaps the table, gets to his feet, and leaves the room. As I wait and listen for approaching footsteps, there is a sharp pain in my stomach. If this doesn't work, I'm here for 5 more years, plus anything more they can possibly tack on. Special Agent Chris Hansky is the senior guy, about my age with a lot of gray hair. Agent Alan Arardi is his younger sidekick. A newspaper article said there are now 40 FBI agents working on the Fawcett case, and I assume these guys are pretty far down the chain of command. This first meeting will be important, as will all of them. But they've clearly sent a couple of foot soldiers to check me out. The warden is not in the room. I figure he's back in his office, not far away, with an ear stuck to the door. They begin without using pens and notepads, a clear sign they are here for a little amusement. Nothing serious. I guess they're not smart enough to realize I've spent hours across the table from FBI agents. So you want to make a deal, Hansky says. I know who killed Judge Fawcett, and I know why. If this information is of any value to the FBI, then yes, we might be able to make a deal. You're assuming we don't already know, Hansky says. I'm sure you don't. If you did, why would you be here? We were told to be here because we're checking every possible lead, and we doubt seriously if this will lead anywhere. Try me. They exchange cocky looks, fun and games. So you give us the name, and what do you get in return? I get out of prison, and I get protection. That's simple. No, it's actually very complicated. This guy is a nasty character, and he has friends who are even nastier. Plus, I'm not willing to wait 2 years until he's convicted. If I give you the name, I get out now, immediately. What if he's not convicted? That's your problem. If you screw up the prosecution, you can't blame me. At this point, Arardi takes out his notepad, uncaps a cheap pen, and writes something down. I have their attention. They're still working much too hard to appear nonchalant, but these guys are under pressure. Their little task force is scrambling because they have no credible leads, according to the newspapers. Hansky continues. What if you give us the wrong name? Let's say we go chasing after the wrong suspect. Meanwhile, you're a free man. I'll never be a free man. You'll be out of prison. And looking over my shoulder for the rest of my life. We've never lost an informant in witness protection. Over 8,000 and counting. That's what you advertise. Frankly, I'm not too concerned with your track record or what didn't happen to the others. I'm worried about my own skin. There is a pause as Arardi stops writing and decides to speak. This guy sounds like he's in a gang of some sort. Maybe a drug dealer. What else can you tell us? Nothing. And I've told you nothing. You can make all the wild guesses you want. Hansky smiles at nothing that is humorous. I doubt if our boss will be too impressed with your scheme to get out of prison. As of today, we've had at least two other inmates contact us and claim to have valuable information. Of course, they want out of prison too. This is not unusual. I have no way of knowing if this is true, but it sounds believable. The knot in my stomach has not gone away. I shrug, offer a smile, tell myself to stay cool. You guys can play it any way you want. Obviously, you're in charge. You can keep beating your heads against a wall. You can waste time with these other inmates. It's up to you. But when you want to know the name of the person who killed Judge Fawcett, I can give it to you. Someone you met in prison? Arardi asks. Or maybe out of prison. You'll never know until we have a deal. There is a long pause as they stare at me and I stare right back. Finally, Arardi closes his notepad and sticks his pen back in his pocket. Hansky says, okay, we'll go tell our boss. You know where to find me. Several times a week, I meet my white gang at the track, and we walk in wide circles around a field used for soccer and flag football. Carl, the optometrist, will be out in a few months. Kermit, the land speculator, has 2 more years. Wesley, The state senator should get out about the same time I do. Mark is the only one with his case still in appeal. He's been here for 18 months and says his lawyer is optimistic, though he freely admits he falsified some mortgage documents. We don't talk much about our crimes, and this is usually true in prison. Who you were or what you did on the outside is not important, and it's also too painful to dwell on. Wesley's wife has just filed for divorce and he's taking it hard. Since I've been through it, as has Kermit, we offer advice and try to cheer him up. I would love to entertain them with the details of my visit from the FBI, but this must be kept quiet. If my plan works, they will show up one day for a walk, and I'll be gone. Suddenly transferred to another camp, for reasons they will never know. Chapter 7. The FBI's temporary headquarters for its Fawcett Task Force was a warehouse in an industrial park near the Roanoke Regional Airport. When last occupied, the space had been leased by a company that imported shrimp from Central America and froze it for years. Almost immediately, it was tagged the freezer. It offered plenty of space, seclusion, and privacy away from the press. Carpenters hurriedly built walls and sectioned off rooms, offices, hallways, and meeting places. Technicians from Washington worked around the clock to install the latest high-tech gear and gadgets for communication, data, and security. Trucks filled with rented furniture and equipment ran nonstop until the CC, command center, was stuffed with more desks and tables than would ever be used. A fleet of rented SUVs filled the parking lot. A catering service was hired to haul in 3 meals a day for the team, which soon numbered close to 70, about 40 agents plus support staff. There was no budget and no concern for costs. The victim was, after all, a federal judge. A lease was signed for 6 months, but after 3 weeks of little progress, there was a general mood among the feds that they might be there longer. Aside from a short list of randomly picked suspects, all of whom were known to be violent and had appeared before Fawcett in the past 18 years, there were no real leads. A man named Stax had written the judge a threatening letter in 2002 from prison. Stax was found working in a liquor store in Panama City Beach, Florida, and had an alibi for the weekend the judge and Ms. Clary were murdered. Stax had not set foot in Virginia in at least 5 years. A narco-trafficker named Ruiz had cursed his honor in Spanish when given a 20-year sentence in 1999. Ruiz was still in a medium-security prison, but after a few days digging through his past, the FBI decided his former cadre of coke runners were all either dead or in prison too. One team methodically sifted through every case Fawcett handled during his 18 years on the bench. He had been a workhorse, handling 300 cases each year, both civil and criminal, while the average for a federal judge is 225. Judge Fawcett had sentenced approximately 3,100 men and women to prison. Laboring under the admittedly shaky assumption that his killer was one of these, a team burned hundreds of hours adding names to its list of possible suspects and then discarding them. Another team studied the cases, both civil and criminal, pending before the judge when he was murdered. Another team spent all of its time on the Armana Mines litigation, with particular attention paid to a couple of flaky environmental extremists who didn't like Fawcett. From the moment it got itself organized, the freezer was a swarming hive of tension, with urgent meetings, frayed nerves, dead ends by the hour, careers on the line, and someone always barking from Washington. The press called nonstop. The bloggers were feeding the frenzy with creative and blatantly false rumors. Then, an inmate named Malcolm Bannister
entered the picture. The task force was run by Victor Westlake, a 30-year career agent who had a nice office with a nice view in the Hoover Building on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington. However, for almost 3 weeks now, he had been holed up in a freshly painted room with no windows in the center of the CC. It was by no means his first road trip. Westlake had made his name years earlier as a master organizer who could rush to the scene of the crime, line up the troops, handle 1,000 details, plan the attack, and solve the crime. He had once spent a year in a motel near Buffalo stalking a genius who got his kicks sending parcel bombs to federal meat inspectors. Turned out to be the wrong genius, but Westlake did not make the mistake of arresting his prey. 2 years later, he nailed his bomber. Westlake was in his office, standing as always behind his desk, when agents Hansky and Arardi entered. Since their boss was standing, they stood too. He believed that it was unhealthy, even deadly, to sit for hours behind a desk.
"Okay, I'm listening," he barked, snapping his fingers.
Hansky quickly said, "Guy's name is Malcolm Bannister, black male, aged 43, in for 10 for RICO violations, federal court in D.C., former lawyer from Winchester, Virginia. Says he can deliver the name of the killer along with his motive, but of course he wants out of prison." Arardi added, "Out immediately, but also protection."
"What a surprise. A con wants out. Is he believable?"
Hansky shrugged.
"For a con, I suppose. The warden says the guy is not a bullshitter. Record is squeaky clean. Says we should listen to the guy."
"What'd he give you?"
"Absolutely nothing. The guy is pretty smart. He might actually know something, and if he does, then this may be his only chance to walk."
Westlake began to pace behind his desk, across the slick concrete floor, to one wall with fresh sawdust scattered in front of it. He paced back to his desk.
"What kind of lawyer was he? Criminal? Drug dealers?"
Hansky replied,
"Small town. General practice, some criminal experience, not much trial work, though. A former Marine."
As a former Marine himself, Westlake liked this.
"His military record?"
4 years, honorable discharge, fought in the first Gulf War. His father was a Marine and a Virginia State Trooper."
"What took him down?"
"You're not going to believe it.
Barry the Backhander."
Westlake frowned and smiled at the same time.
"Come on. Seriously. He handled some real estate transactions for Barry and got caught up in the storm. As you'll recall, the jury nailed them on RICO and conspiracy charges. I think there were 8 of them tried at the same time. Bannister was a small fish who got caught in a wide net."
"Any connection to Fawcett?"
"Not yet. We just got his name 3 hours ago."
"You got a plan?"
"Sort of," Hansky said. "If we assume Bannister knows the killer, then it's safe to assume they met in prison. Doubtful that he would have met the guy on the quiet streets of Winchester, much more likely that their paths crossed in prison. Bannister has been in for 5 years, with the first 22 months in Louisville, Kentucky, a medium security prison with a population of 2,000. Since then, he's been at Frostburg, a camp with 600 inmates. That's a lot of people.
Plus, they come and go," Westlake said.
"Right. So let's start at the logical place. Let's get his prison records, the names of his cellmates, maybe dorm mates. We'll go to the 2 prisons, talk to the wardens, the unit managers, the COs, talk to anyone who might know something about Bannister and his friends. We'll begin collecting names and we'll see how many crossed paths with Fawcett."
Arardi added,
"He says the killer has nasty friends, thus the desire for protection. Sounds like a gang of some variety. Once we start adding names, we'll concentrate on those with gang connections."
A pause. Then a doubtful Westlake said,
"And that's it?"
"It's the best we can do for now."
Westlake clicked his heels together, arched his back, gripped his hands behind his head,
and breathed deeply. He stretched and breathed and stretched, then said, "Okay, collect the prison records and get started. How many hands do you need?" "Can you spare two men?" "No, but you can have them. Go. Get started." Barry the backhander. The client I never met until they dragged us into federal court one gray morning and read the entire indictment aloud. In a ham and egg storefront law office, you learn the basics of many mundane legal tasks, but it's difficult to specialize. I tried to avoid divorce and bankruptcy, and I never liked real estate. But to survive, I often had to take who and what walked in the door. Oddly, it would be real estate that brought about the fall. The referral came from a law school pal who was working for a mid-sized firm in central D.C. The firm had a client who wished to purchase a hunting lodge in Shenandoah County, in the foothills of the Allegheny Mountains, about an hour southwest of Winchester. The client desired great secrecy and demanded anonymity, which should have been the first warning sign. The purchase price was $4 million, and after some haggling, I negotiated a flat fee of $100,000 for Copeland, Reed, and Bannister to handle the transaction. Such a fee had never been seen by me or my partners, and we were excited, initially. I set my other files aside and went to research the land records in Shenandoah County. The lodge was about 20 years old and had been built by some doctors who enjoyed grouse hunting. But as happens with many such ventures, the partners had reached a disagreement. A serious one involving lawyers and lawsuits, even a bankruptcy or two. After a couple of weeks, though, I had things sorted out, and delivering a clean title opinion to my still anonymous client would be no problem. A closing date was set, and I prepared all the necessary contracts and deeds. There was a lot of paperwork, but then again, we were going to earn a rather fat fee. The closing was delayed a month, and I asked my law school pal for $50,000, or half of the attorney's fees. This was not uncommon, and since I had invested 100 hours at this point, I wanted to get paid. He called back to say the client would not agree. No big deal, I thought. In a typical real estate transaction, the attorneys are not paid until the closing takes place. I was informed that my client, a corporation, had changed its name. I redrafted the documents and waited. The closing was again delayed, and the sellers began threatening to walk away. During this time, I was vaguely aware of the name and reputation of a Beltway operative by the name of Barry Rafko, or, more famously, Barry the Backhander. He was about 50 years old, and for most of his adult life had been rummaging around D.C. looking for a lazy way to make a buck. He had been a consultant, a strategist, an analyst, a fundraiser, and a spokesman, and he had worked at the lower levels of a few election campaigns of congressmen and senators, both Democratic and Republican. Didn't matter to Barry. If he was getting paid, he could strategize and analyze from either side of the street. He hit his stride, though, when he and a partner opened a lounge near the Capitol. Barry hired some young hookers to tend bar in miniskirts, and almost overnight, the place became a favorite meat market for the legions of staffers who swarmed the Hill. Low-ranking congressmen and mid-ranking bureaucrats discovered the place, and Barry was on the map. With his pockets full of cash, his next venture was an upscale steakhouse 2 blocks from his lounge. He catered to lobbyists and offered great steaks and wines at reasonable prices. And before long, senators were getting their preferred tables. Barry loved sports and bought lots of tickets: Redskins, Capitals, Wizards, Georgetown Hoyas, which he gave away to his friends. By this time, he had founded his own governmental relations firm, and it was growing rapidly. He and his partner had a fight,
and Barry bought his interest in their holdings. Alone, wealthy, and fueled by ambition, Barry set his sights on the top of his profession. Unrestrained by ethical considerations, he became one of the most aggressive purveyors of influence in Washington. If a rich client wanted a new loophole in the tax code, Barry could hire someone to write it, insert it, convince his friends to support it, and then do a masterful job of covering it up. If a rich client needed to expand a factory back home, Barry could arrange a deal whereby the congressman would secure the earmark, send the money home to the factory, and pocket a sizable check for his re-election efforts. Everyone would be thrilled. In his first brush with the law, he was accused of slipping cash to a senior advisor to a U.S. senator. The charge didn't stick, but the nickname did. Barry the Backhander. Because he operated on the sleazier side of an often sleazy business, Barry knew the power of money and sex. His yacht on the Potomac became a notorious love boat, famous for wild parties and plenty of young women. He owned a golf course in South Carolina where he took members of Congress for long weekends, usually without their wives. For Barry, though, the more powerful he became, the more risks he was willing to take. Old friends drifted away, frightened by troubles that seemed inevitable. His name was mentioned in an ethics investigation in the House. The Washington Post picked up his scent, and Barry Rafko, a man who had always craved attention, was getting more than his share. I had no idea, no real way of knowing that the hunting lodge was one of his projects. The corporate name changed again. The paperwork was redone. Another closing was delayed, then a new proposal. My client wanted to lease the lodge for 1 year at the rate of $200,000 a month, with all rentals to be applied to the purchase price. This led to a week of intense bickering, but a deal was finally reached. I reworked the contracts again and insisted my firm be paid half of our fee. This was done, and Mr. Copeland and Mr. Reed were somewhat relieved. When the contracts were finally signed, my client was an offshore company operating on the tiny island of St. Kitts, and I still had no idea who was behind it. The contracts were signed by an unseen corporate representative down there in the Caribbean and shipped overnight to my office. As per our agreement, my client would wire into our law firm trust account the sum of $450,000 and some change, enough to cover the lease payments for the first 2 months, plus the remainder of our fee, plus some miscellaneous expenses. I would in turn write a $200,000 check to the sellers for each of the first 2 months. Then my client would replenish the account. After 12 months of this, the lease would be converted to a sale, with our little firm due another sizable fee. When the wired funds hit our bank, the banker called to inform me that our trust account had just received $4.5 million, as opposed to $450,000. I figured someone got carried away with the zeros. Plus, there could be worse things than having far too much money in the bank. But something didn't add up. I tried to contact the shell company that was technically my client on St. Kitts, but got the runaround. I contacted the law school pal who had referred the case, and he promised to look into the matter. I distributed the first month's rent and the attorney's fee to our firm and waited for instructions to wire out the excess. Days passed, then weeks. A month later, the banker called to say that another $3 million had just landed in our trust account. By this time, Mr. Reed and Mr. Copeland were deeply disturbed. I instructed my banker to get rid of the money, wire it back to the source from whence it came, and do so quickly. He grappled with this for a couple of days, only to find that the account in St. Kitts had been closed. Finally, my law school pal emailed me instructions to wire half the money to an account in Grand Cayman and the other half to an account in Panama. As a small-time lawyer, I had zero experience wiring money to numbered accounts, but a few moments of light Google research revealed that I was walking blindly through some of the most notorious tax havens in the world. I wished I had never agreed to work for the anonymous client, in spite of the money. The wire to Panama bounced back, some $3.5 million. I yelled at my law school pal, and he yelled at someone up the line. The money stayed put for 2 months, drawing interest, though we could not ethically keep any of it. Ethics also required me to take all steps necessary to protect this unwanted money. It was not mine, and I certainly made no claim to it, but nonetheless, I had to safeguard it. Innocently, or perhaps stupidly, I had allowed the tainted money of Barry the Backhander to rest under the control of Copeland, Reed, and Bannister. Once he had possession of the hunting lodge, Barry did a quick renovation, spruced it up a little, built a spa, and put in a heliport. He leased a Sikorsky S-76 helicopter, and it took about 20 minutes to haul 10 of Barry's best friends from D.C. to the hunting lodge. On a typical Friday afternoon, several shuttles were made and the partying began. By this time in his career, he had cast aside most bureaucrats and lobbyists and concentrated primarily on congressmen and their chiefs of staff. At the lodge, everything was available. Great food and wine, Cuban cigars, drugs, 30-year-old scotch, and 20-year-old women. An occasional grouse hunt got organized, but the guests were usually more preoccupied with the stunning collection of tall blondes at their disposal. The girl was from Ukraine. During the trial, my trial, her handler said in thickly accented English that he had been paid $100,000 cash for the girl, who was taken to the hunting lodge and given a room. The cash had been handed over by a thug who testified, for the prosecution, that he had been one of Barry's many bagmen. The girl died. The autopsy revealed she had overdosed after a long night of partying with Barry and his friends from Washington. There were rumors that she failed to wake up one morning while in bed with a U.S. congressman, though this could not be proven. Barry circled the wagons long before the authorities arrived on the scene. Whom the girl had slept with during her last night on Earth would never be revealed. A media storm erupted around Barry, his businesses, his friends, his jets, yachts, helicopters, restaurants, resorts, and the width and depth of his sordid influence. As the press stampeded to Barry, his cronies and clients sprinted away. Outraged members of Congress chased down reporters and demanded hearings and investigations. The story turned much worse when the girl's mother was located in Kiev. She produced a birth certificate showing her late daughter to be only 16 years old. A 16-year-old sex slave partying with members of Congress at a hunting lodge in the Allegheny Mountains, barely a 2-hour drive from the U.S. Capitol. The original indictment ran on for 100 pages and accused 14 defendants of an astonishing variety of crimes. I was one of the 14, and my alleged crime had been what is commonly known as money laundering. By allowing one of Barry Rafko's faceless corporations to park money in my firm's trust account, I had supposedly helped him take dirty cash he pilfered from clients, scrub it up a bit offshore, then turn it into a valuable asset, the hunting lodge. I was also accused of helping Barry hide money from the FBI, the IRS, and others. Pre-trial maneuvering eliminated some of the defendants. Several were allowed to peel off and either cooperate with the government or have their own separate trials. My lawyer and I filed 22 motions from the day I was indicted until the day I went to trial. And only one was granted, and it was a useless win. The Department of Justice,
through its FBI and U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C., through everything it had against Barry Rafko and his Confederates, including one congressman and one of his aides. It didn't matter if a couple of us might be innocent, nor did it matter that our version of the truth would be distorted by the government. There I was, sitting in a crowded courtroom with seven other defendants, including the most nefarious political operative Washington had produced in decades. I was guilty, all right. Guilty of stupidity for allowing myself to fall into such a mess. After the jury was selected, the U.S. attorney offered me one last deal. Plead to one RICO violation, pay a fine of $10,000, and serve 2 years. Once again, I told him to go to hell. I was innocent. Chapter 8. Please forward to Mr. Victor Westlake, Assistant Director FBI, Hoover Building, 935 Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington, D.C., 20535. Dear Mr. Westlake, my name is Malcolm Bannister, and I am an inmate at the federal prison camp at Frostburg, Maryland. On Monday, February 21st, 2011, I met with two of your agents investigating the murder of Judge Fawcett, Agents Hansky and Arardi. Nice guys and all, but I got the feeling they were not too impressed with me and my story. According to this morning's reports in the Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Roanoke Times, you and your team are still chasing your tails and don't have much of a clue. I have no way of knowing if you have a list of credible suspects, but I can guarantee you the real killer is not on any list compiled by you and your team. As I explained to Hansky and Arardi, I know the identity of the killer, and I know his motive. In case Hansky and Arardi screwed up the details, and by the way, their note-taking was not too impressive, here is my idea of a deal. I reveal the killer, and you, the government, agree to my release from prison. I will not consider some type of conditional suspension of my sentence. I will not consider parole. I walk out a free man with a new identity and protection by the guys on your side. Obviously, such a deal will necessitate the involvement of the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney's offices in both the Northern and the Southern districts of Virginia. Also, I want the reward money, to which I will be entitled. According to the Roanoke Times this morning, it has just been increased to $150,000. Please feel free to continue chasing your tails. As a couple of former Marines, we really should talk. You know where to find me. Sincerely, Malcolm Bannister, number 44861-127. My cellie is a 19-year-old black kid from Baltimore, in for 8 years for selling crack. Gerard is like 1,000 other guys I've seen in the past 5 years. A young black from the inner cities whose mother was a teenager when he was born and whose father was long gone. He dropped out of school in the 10th grade and found a job as a dishwasher. When his mother went to prison,